Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is Andrew Cole, Head of Multi-Asset at Pictet Asset Management. Increasing trade tensions, Brexit, and an uncertain economic outlook are just some of the threats investors face. As a result, there's an increasing need to find ways to mitigate potential downside, such as adding funds which aim to mitigate downside to your portfolio. Andrew, you run funds including FP Pictet Multi-Asset Portfolio, a targeted absolute return fund which aims for positive return in excess of 3-month sterling LIBOR over 12-month rolling periods. How do you try to achieve positive returns, in particular during uncertain periods such as just now, when markets face a number of threats?
Look, we're long only. We're asset allocators. We're prepared to be active. And we're prepared to make meaningful changes in our asset allocation. One, to capture returns as and when we think they're available. But secondly, you know, we have an asymmetric view about risk, is that you want to avoid sharp drawdowns. And so we are prepared to, you know, cut risk, hold cash at times of market stress with a desire of, you know, trying to defend capital. We recognize that, you know, one disastrous year destroys several years of growth. And, you know, the secret to long-run investing, of course, is compounding returns. So, of course, if your portfolio halves, you've got to double to get back to where you started. So it's pretty helpful in the long run if you don't let that happen. So, look, in short, we'll make meaningful changes to our asset allocation.
Okay, now you said you long only, so presumably you don't short, but do you use any other derivatives or hedge fund style techniques to try to maintain positive returns?
We're not financial engineers, so we don't utilise leverage, we don't do relative value. You know, for us that means you've got to get two things right at the same time, and frankly, in my lifetime, you know, getting one thing right is difficult enough. But do we use derivatives? Look, I think, you know, from time to time, and I think, you know, this year has been, you know, one of those years when we have used derivatives, principally call or put options, because, you know, whilst we all think it's an uncertain world, actually, the market pricing of volatility has been extraordinarily low. So being able to own a call, i.e., give me the upside and limit my downside risk to markets, has been a particularly cheap function to put into portfolios this year. And we've used that to our advantage, and certainly during the summer, that has helped us, you know, keep our return profile more stable during a period of, you know, what's been, you know, a more volatile period for stock markets in particular.
Now, some of our listeners may not be familiar with what put and call options are. Can you just briefly explain what they are and how they, you know, how they work and benefit?
Absolutely. So, you know, if we take, you know, the UK market, and, you know, clearly, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but actually the market's pricing of how volatile the UK stock market is going to be has largely spent most of this year at multi-year lows. And that what that allows us to do is to say, is to pay a very small premium, that if the market were to rise, let's say 1%, then over and above that, we will have exposure to the market. But should the market fall, all we're losing is the small amount of insurance premium that we've paid to capture that upside. And, you know, and the inverse would be true for a put. So you thought the market was going to go down and you wanted to protect against equities you might have. I mean, that's certainly the way we would play it, rather than having a net short exposure to the market. And so you can pay what have been quite small premiums this year in order to defend your portfolio to downside risks.
FP Pictet Multi-Asset Portfolio launched in 2015. Have you managed to achieve positive returns over rolling 12-month periods since this launch date?
Certainly, yeah. We've done more than that. I mean, our real objective, if you like, is to grow the real value of the fund. Mm. You know, we believe that most savers invest to grow the real value of their wealth. So we really want to see a rate of return over above inflation. And we've certainly achieved that over the last 5 years.
over that period, I mean, what has detracted from returns? What would be examples of things that detracted?
Oh, well, you can pick any particular given period. Clearly bonds, by and large, have generally been helpful. Equity exposure, well, you know, it's been a case of being exposed to the right places. The US market and technology over that 5-year period has tended to outperform. A growth style of equity investing has certainly over the last 2 or 3 years significantly outperformed. I just want to own cheap value stocks. And so avoiding energy, financials within our equity market exposure has been incredibly helpful. But as I said at the outset, look, we will make meaningful changes to our portfolio because at any moment in time, we seek to have more money invested in what we think are going to be the best performing assets. And if we don't like something, we do our best not to own it. So, if we look at our history of our asset allocation over the last 5 years, our equity weight, if you like, and if you want to think about that as a measure of risk, has varied from, 70% in equities down to a low of, 10 to 15%. Mm. So, do we get it right all of the time? No, but we try and get it right, more often than not, and over the period that served us well.
Mm. What would be an example of what you haven't got right?
What would be an example? Well, look, we've struggled with European equities. We haven't had the greatest track record at getting involved in Europe. And that said, we've got more exposure to Europe today than we've had for a long while, and I think that's partly because European economic growth has, perhaps persistently disappointed. But from a more structural perspective, European investors, regardless of how cheap European equities might look relative to European bonds, seem very reluctant buyers. And, to some extent, perhaps that's been, the regulatory backdrop. And that's caught us on the hop, one or two times, but, we've had plenty of successes the other side of that in such as things not being frightened of owning what have at the time seemed to be, relatively expensive technology stocks, but recognizing that actually their earnings are going to surprise positively and the market will respond by pushing up valuations higher from time to time.
Okay. Now, the US, I suppose it came out a couple of days ago, said it may impose tariffs on European Union goods, which I suppose could ignite another trade war. How serious a threat is this to markets? And what can investors do to mitigate any possible risks?
Our stance on certainly US trade, particularly with China, I think is going to be, something that as investors, we're going to have to learn to live with, for the foreseeable future. And I would liken it to sort of the new Cold War, and we can go into why if you want to. Are we seeing some spillover into Europe?
Mm.
Yes, I think it's a sign of the times that, an increase in sort of populism and that sort of political rhetoric is that, regimes are starting to think about their local electorates and their local workforce to a much greater extent than we've seen in the past. And, Donald Trump and the United States, are part of that. Actually, the EU is less of a free trade group outside of itself than we might be disposed to think. I think trade friction is something that we should get used to. I think it is a threat to corporate profit margins, if you like. We're throwing some sand in the engine of global trade, and that creates some friction, and I think will create some extra costs, which I think the corporate sector is going to bear, and that is a threat to record high margins.
Mm.
But look, let's never underestimate the ability of the corporate sector to respond to a changing environment. And, you know, we seek to do that. And whilst we've not necessarily thought about the immediate impacts of, you know, the European angle on this, when thinking about US-China trade, we like some of the other South Asian markets where, you know, that trade is being relocated. So we particularly like, you know, the banks in, you know, the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia. I think we'll be immediate beneficiaries of, you know, that repositioning of trade routes and that supply chain. So, yeah, that's how we think about it.
Okay. And just from the European perspective, you know, is there any areas to avoid or, you know, kind of favour? Is it a bit early to say? Because obviously that dispute is a much earlier trade than the US-China trade dispute.
I think a lot of this is probably about autos and cars. And there, you know, we've seen, you know, a complete collapse in, you know, auto sales over, you know, the last 12 to 18 months. Is that cyclical? Is it structural? I think only time will tell. You know, for your listeners that are old enough to remember the sort of VHS Betamax problem of which technology do I go? You know, this is a reasonably big ticket item. I think that's exactly where the car industry is today. The consumer sits there and says, well, you know, do I go electric? Do I go hybrid? I'm probably less inclined to go diesel. Should I go petrol still? Actually, you know, if I don't want to buy the wrong technology, I'm going to sit on my hands for a while. And I think that's, to some extent, what the car industry is suffering from. And, you know, time will tell. But my suspicion is that this will work its way out at the system quicker than we might imagine. But I think, you know, trade right now is, you know, autos. You know, it's sentimental to the US workforce. And, you know, you've clearly seen the ramifications in Germany where, you know, the manufacturing data and the trade data has been particularly poor. And we associate Germany clearly with, you know, car manufacture.
Now, we've been talking, I suppose, probably to a certain extent about equities. But these companies also issue bonds. So, I mean, could such a trade war between the US and Europe, if it develops in an unpleasant way, have a negative effect on European bonds?
Bonds have got all sorts of headwinds. So if we think about sovereign government bonds, I mean, we do live in a period of financial repression where actually to own a government bond today almost ensures that you will become poorer, i.e. your prospective return is going to be below the rate of inflation. And in fact, I was doing the arithmetic, you know, just yesterday that actually to buy a 10-year gilt today and expect to get a return over and above inflation, the sort of 0.7 yield you get today, you will need the yield on that security to be minus 1.6 in 5 years' time. Now, that strikes me as being pretty unlikely. And so, you know, that's an immediate headwind for bonds. You know, they're going to make me poorer. Now, so what has everybody done? You know, that you've seen a flight into corporate bonds, both investment grade and high yield, where the amount of extra yield you get for taking that credit risk has fallen dramatically over the last 5 years. And if there's an asset class that we think is, you know, expensive and we want to avoid owning today, it has been, you know, it is corporate bonds where, you know, actually the quality of the bond, i.e. the amount of leverage, the indebtedness of the company that you're investing in is probably higher. And therefore the risks of a default or that bond going bad are underestimated in the extra yield you're getting. So, by and large, there's something like, you know, 17 trillion bonds out there now with yields less than zero. If you're planning on, you know, growing the real value of your wealth, why would you want to own them? You know, whereas I say, it's a period of financial repression where to some extent, you know, the regulators, certainly for life companies and DB pension schemes, kind of force investors into these uneconomic investments. But it's a way in which wealth is redistributed.
Okay. Now, on that note, you said in a recent commentary that you do favour bonds which offer positive real yields from issuers based where central banks have room to cut further. What areas are these and what types of bonds are they?
So what we're largely talking about here are inflation-linked bonds, by and large, generally. Mm. And so anybody who looks at the inflation-linked gilt market, for instance, in the UK, will see that yields are, you know, significantly negative, you know, minus 1.5 to minus 2.5, i.e. that's the amount by which you are going to get poorer in real terms. When we look at the United States, actually those real yields are positive. So for us, that seems a pretty attractive place to be relative. In places like Australia, you know, we've seen, you know, expected inflation falling. We thought that the central bank had more room to cut real yields. And so certainly for much of this year, our focus in owning government bonds has been in those inflation-linked bonds in the United States. And actually in Australia, been prepared to own conventional government bonds.
Hmm. Do you invest in these directly or do you invest in via other funds?
Our fund has the ability, I mean, it has complete open architecture. Certainly when it comes to government securities, we try to be fairly focused in what we own. So we'll pick individual bonds and individual securities and hold them that way. And then think about whether we want to have the currency exposure or not. And if we don't, we'll hedge that currency exposure back into pounds.
Okay. Now, you recently cut exposure to emerging markets' local currency debt, despite the fact that these types of bonds offer attractive yields. Why?
Because I think we're in an environment where, you know, we probably, you know, see a bit more risk around, you know, people wanting to de-risk. And I think that probably sends the dollar higher.
Hmm.
And a strengthening dollar puts an immediate strain, particularly on emerging market central banks. You know, they find an environment where the dollar is weakening and where they try and peg their currencies a much easier environment with which to run their own monetary policy. A strengthening dollar, I think, means that there's a big headwind for emerging market central banks, by and large, to be able to cut rates to lower real yields. And so, look, from a strategic perspective, we think they're attractive, but right now, technically, as I said, you know, we'd stand aside and wait for better value and a better opportunity.
Talking of, I guess, risks or threats going ahead, what would you say are the other sort of like main ones and how have you positioned the fund to mitigate them?
Look, there are always threats. Mm. There are always risks, right? You know, and if as an investor and you wake up on the day and you think, well, this is great, there's nothing to worry about, you should probably actually sell everything. So look, the trade war, I think, is kind of known. Could it escalate? Yeah, well, look, it could. But I think, you know, most parties recognize that there'll be quite a lot of jawboning, and I think the market recognizes it. Clearly, Brexit throws in some uncertainty, yeah, less than perhaps the market perceives, in my opinion. I think the most immediate threat is that clearly we've seen slowing economic activity, particularly in the manufacturing sector. And so, you know, when we look at our economic indicators, our leading indicators of economic growth have been slowing. But this is all up until this point been largely down to manufacturing. Actually, the consumer sentiment and jobs market has remained fairly buoyant. The big risk from here is that actually concerns within the manufacturing, concerns with companies not willing to invest, means that actually they go the other way and at the margin start shedding labor, and that we see, you know, real income gains or real wage growth dissipate, you know, a slight rise perhaps in the unemployment. And that would damage consumer sentiment and consumption. And if that were to happen, I think, you know, there are, you know, much greater sort of downside risks. And then we're much more likely to be talking about a recessionary scenario. And we kind of know what recessions do to corporate profits. They tend to hit them fairly painfully. So that's that, I would say, is the biggest risk right here and now. And it's not just one that, you know, the UK suffers from. It's pretty much a global phenomenon.
Okay. Now, I've been talking lots about equities and bonds, but FP Pictet Multi-Asset Portfolio, like the name implies, is a multi-asset fund. So what other assets do you invest in to mitigate downside?
Well, look, we're not frightened of owning cash. It doesn't always fulfil, as I say, our real return objective, but it does give you the option to buy things, you know, as and when they cheapen up and you think the returns are there. So, you know, today we're pretty much at, you know, 30% cash. What else do we own in the portfolio? Well, we have some gold. You know, as I said, I think we're in a period of financial repression where actually most central banks would like to try and engineer some inflation. That looks pretty difficult, where the real return on cash is, you know, negative. And, you know, if you're going to make your interest rate negative, then actually gold looks like a high yielder when it yields zero. So we have some gold. Outside of that, I mean, I think we're attracted to real assets that have other contracted cash flows associated with them. So, you know, for a while, and you know, we've owned aircraft leases where we think, you know, we get the lease and we think, you know, a bit of inflation, the depreciation rate on your plane is attractive. And more recently in the last year, despite all the concerns about global trade, I'm actually, you know, owning ships and commercial ships, particularly freight, have become particularly attractive. And some of that is technology, because of, you know, new regulation on emissions. And the other thing is that actually in a slower global trade, what you tend to find is that merchants tend to move their ships more slowly. And if you think about it, if you're moving ships more slowly, you actually need more ships. So that's been, you know, another sort of diversifier, stable contractual income into the portfolio. But I mean, I would say that, you know, by and far, you know, the big one at the moment is we've got cash.
Now, when you access more esoteric assets like the aircraft leasing and the ships, how do you do it? Is it directly or via funds?
We'll do that via, by and large listed securities.
Okay.
We don't do private partnerships. We don't, you know, participate in, you know, unlisted securities. You know, our strategy, whilst we've run it at Pictet for 5 years, actually, you know, our strategy and philosophy we've managed since 2001, and we've always been conscious that, you know, for two reasons. If we want to make a meaningful change in our asset allocation, then we need to have the liquidity in markets to do that. And secondly, when it comes to perhaps some of our defined benefit pension scheme clients, yeah, most of them would like to get to buyout, and should we do a good job for them and they get to the point where they're fully funded and they say, right, we can go to buyout, they ring us and say, can we have our money back? And we've always wanted to be in a position where we could say, absolutely, thank you.
Yeah, so liquidity, a key concern then.
Indeed.
Yeah. Obviously, when you're looking at these underlying funds, I mean, what sort of things do you assess when you're looking and considering, you know, kind of liquidity and liquidity issues?
Okay, so look, first and foremost, we're not really a manager of funds. Where we do own a fund, and it might be a Pictet fund or it might be something managed externally, if we think we can get a better bang for our buck by doing that, you know, we want to own something that's big and liquid, and we don't want to own so much of it that we're going to cause a problem for us or indeed, you know, the other fund manager should we decide that we want to sell. That's been, you know, the way we've operated for the last 20 years, and I don't see any reason to change. You know, we do all of the due diligence and take a pretty cautious stance on the amount of liquidity that we've had. I mean, I think it's, you know, we've seen some high profile cases of late. I'm not surprised, and we've never wanted to be in that position.
No. So, I mean, do you favour any types of fund structures? Because obviously there's the argument that if you invest in liquid assets, whether it be property, aircraft leases or anything else, do it via a listed fund, aka an investment trust, rather than an open-ended fund, or how, you know, what's your
My immediate answer is, look, if you own a closed-ended listed structure like an investment trust, there's always going to be a price at which you can sell.
Mm.
Right now, it might be at a big discount to its net asset value, but you're going to be able to sell. It's more troublesome when you're in an open structure and where the manager might use his discretion to gate or close to defend, quite rightly, frankly, his other unit holders. Mm. So, you know, we're aware of that and, you know, be conscious of that. And as I say, if we're going to use an open-ended structure, you know, we'll limit, you know, we've got strong constraints in terms of how much of that we have. And we tend to work with the other manager to ensure that should we decide that we want to be able to sell, we're in a position to do so.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. A really interesting insight into mitigating downside via diversification and managing liquidity. That brings us to the end of today's show, but also have a look at this week's Investors Chronicle or the website at investorschronicle.co.uk for more on mitigating downside, diversifying your portfolio and funds focused on illiquid assets. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.